I don't read enough of that, of their literature, how far they want to take it. But the general point is an old point. There's this famous story about a letter from Alfred Marshall, who's really the founder, in some sense, of conventional neoclassical economics, where he says that he always works out his ideas mathematically to make sure they're right. He then translates them into English. And if he can't translate them into English, he burns the mathematics. That's the great lie. And I've wondered since then how much of the economics of the next 100 years went into his fireplace. But it seems to me it's a legitimate point, and that on the one hand, mathematics does provide you more precise ways of thinking about certain things than English does. And there have been cases when I thought I intuited something, and then I worked it, set up some simple mathematical model and worked out, and it isn't true. So that's nice. And sometimes it will tell you things. I have one example, which is in my price theory textbook and also in Hidden Order, which is an argument that people find very unintuitive, where if you just do a simple budget line indifference curve diagram, the correct answer drops out immediately. And once you see that, you can then figure out why it's true. And this is the following sort of paradox, which was given to me as a puzzle by a colleague at UCLA many, many years ago. You have bought a house. And we will assume that none of the things affecting your desire for housing are going to change. You're not going to have more kids or fewer kids or anything like that. If after you buy the house, the price of housing goes up, are you better or worse off? If after you buy a house, the price of housing goes down, are you better or worse off? That's the puzzle.
And the obvious answer is wrong? Yeah.
What do you think the obvious answer is?
That
both of the obvious answers are wrong.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I thought if the price goes up after you bought it, then you're better off.
You're not planning to sell it, right? The thing that made you, that you could sell it. So you say you're better off if it goes up and worse off if it goes down.
But you might change your mind.
Well, we are assuming that the relevant, that basically your demand curve for housing isn't going to change. Otherwise, it becomes much more complicated. And take the sort of simple picture of it. How about if it goes down? Does that make you worse off?
Yeah.
Why?
You
have to sell the house.
Okay. But what about the other case? Like, if you buy it, the price goes up.
Yes.
And then couldn't you sell it and then buy an equivalent house of...
No, because the equivalent house would also be marked.
It would also be marked. Okay. No.
What about one of these things that banks offer that...
But what might you do? Think this
exactly.
Through. Okay. I know, but I'm not we're interested in it as a house, not as something to buy one. So, but think through your argument a little bit further. Why might you sell it? You wouldn't sell it in order to buy another identical house.
You could start renting.
You're not thinking like economists.
Okay.
What determines how much housing you want to consume? Aside from your demand curve, what's the other thing that determines how much housing you consume?
Your income.
Other things you can
rental.
Buy with this money, and you're comparing it with that.
What determines how much of anything you buy? What does the demand curve show you? What against what?
Price
and quantity.
That's right, and that tells you that quantity is a function of price. And we have just changed the price of housing. So if the price of housing goes up, what might you want to do?
Buy more.
Do you want to buy more? Right, so how do you buy less? You sell your house, you buy a smaller house, and you do that because the extra money you get, it used to be that the value to you of the third bedroom was $50,000. Value of the third bedroom is $50,000, but you can now sell it for $60,000. If houses are more expensive and you trade down, you'll get that amount of money. Does that make sense?
It's like a substitution effect.
It is a substitution effect, of course.
Yeah, but would that really happen?
Depends how large the change is. If the change is very small, no, because of real estate commissions and such. But if the change is large, of course.
I would
sell the large house and get an apartment and use the money for whatever.
Yeah, you have other things they want money for. How about if houses get cheaper? What might you want to do?
Buy a bigger house?
That's right. Exactly. So that if houses get cheaper, the point is that whichever way it changes, you have the option of the combination of wealth and housing you had before, because you can sit in your house. So as long as your circumstances aren't going to change, you can't be made worse off by either change. They both of them make you better off. Because each of them, one simple way of putting it is, you had an opportunity set. You had a set of combinations of housing and other things you could get. You chose the optimal point in that opportunity set. The opportunity set has now changed. That can't make you worse off.
Yes,
but the new area might include some better things.
Yeah.
Now let's look at it. We need a knife would be better than a fork, but that'll do fine. Sure. Let's look at it with a budget line and difference curve diagram. It now becomes absolutely clear. Here is your indifference curve, housing versus all other things. Here is the old price.
Green chicken. The one with green beans, no dairy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Show me what.
Which one?
Which
one
was
it?
Chicken.
That must be mine.
Mine is the. If you already own the house, so you're already here, now what happens when you change the price? What happens to that line?
Wait,
where
are you changing
the price? So this is housing?
One of them is, I don't care. One of them is housing and one of them is all other goods.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is your indifference curve.
Right.
This is your budget line at the old price. This is where you now are, the optimum. All right. What happens when the price changes?
It pivots around
that point precisely.
Yeah.
If this is tangent, then if it pivots either way, it's got to cut the curve. If it cuts the curve, that means that there are areas on higher indifference curves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a good puzzle. It was given to me by a colleague at UCLA a long time ago, and I thought about it for a couple of minutes, and then says, obviously, you're better off either way, and said, it can't be obvious, it wouldn't have taken you a couple of minutes. But I then put it in my price theory textbook, and from time to time, I get an email from them, and say, your answer can't possibly be right, because it's so counterintuitive. Now, it's true, you do have to assume that, you know, your conditions aren't going to change, you're not going to borrow money against it, and so forth. But given all of that, so given the obvious simplifying model kind of thing, but the neat thing is it's a case where the math helps. Because once you see it, you can put it in the other terms.
Right.
But if you just look at the budget line indifference curve, you just had somebody who had no intuition at all, but understood how indifference curves work. You pivot on that point. That's interesting. It cuts it. You can do it this way, too. That answers the question.
Yeah, because you can still take that point.
And you can't be worse off.
That's right.
They mark back in the relevant place
right.
of the main, so
that's
you
right.
Make, you can take
that's right. That's right. That's right. And if you make sort of ordinary assumptions about continuous preferences and such, if we ignore transaction costs of changing, then you have to be better off. Your optimal will be a different one. Anyway. But I just like to use that as an example of a case where the math helps see it. But once you see it, it's now obvious verbally.
I have to break the math. I'm taking probability theory right now, and I have to learn to disregard my intuition a lot. Bad intuition. Yeah, lots of times you think something's supposed to be a certain way to do the math.
Yes. As you may know, the sort of classic example here is the question, how many people do you have to have in a room before it becomes more than even odds that two of them have the same birthday?
Oh, yeah. And afterwards, it does make sense.
Of course.
Yeah. You make the different combinations that people can have.
Yeah, that's right. But
especially with that problem.
Yeah, well, that's a standard problem. But it's not a hard problem. But the answer just turns to be, I don't know what it is, but it's a lower number than you would have guessed. Yeah, that's right.
So one of my questions that has to do with, well, I guess math, why did you switch from physics to economics?
I guess the simple answer was because I decided I was a better economist than physicist. That in physics, I was one of the top grad students at Chicago. So in that sense, I was much better than most people. But that just puts you sort of at the bottom of the professors at Columbia, which is where I then was as a postdoc. I expect I was good enough so I could have made a sort of modest career in physics, but when somebody came to Columbia to give a talk, I was one of the people sitting in the back of the room trying to talk. When somebody comes to an economics department to give a talk, I'm one of the people in the front saying, well, this is wrong, and why don't you do this, and, you know, and so forth and so on. So in that sense, I just had much better intuition. I concluded, and I think I was right, that I had much better intuition for economics than for physics, and, you know, one reason I stayed out of economics was I didn't want to spend my life being labeled my father's son, but I decided that it was worth taking that risk in exchange for doing something I was good at and liked. And I had done some economics at that point. I had done my piece on population, on economics of population, where what basically happened was there's an organization in New York called the Population Council. And the person who was then the head of it thought it would be interesting to see a discussion of population issues written from a pro-free market standpoint. I don't think he particularly had that position. I think he was just sort of the open-minded kind of guy who thought we'd like to see it discussed from something other than the standard intervention viewpoint. And I don't know quite how he got on to me, but he asked me. I mean, I'd been writing stuff sort of at this low level before, but he hired me to write a pamphlet on that. And in writing that, I thought I came up with a variety of original ideas on the subject. I was corresponding, I think, with both my father and Gary Becker at some point on it, and they seemed to think I had interesting and original ideas, so I thought I was really doing something worth doing. And then, at some point after that, there was somebody who ran one of these sort of semi-independent centers at the University of Pennsylvania that was called the Fells Center for State and Local Government, but was really almost an economics department. It was what people in it were mostly doing. And I think he had seen my population piece, and I don't know if he had seen, I don't think my book had come out yet, but I'm not sure, but he offered to find me a position as a postdoc at his center if I wanted to retrain and switch into economics. And so I took him up on that offer, and I spent 2 years as a postdoc and 1 year as a lecturer at Penn. And during that time, I wrote my article on the size and shape of nations, which is one I'm still very fond of. And that was accepted by the Journal of Political Economy, which is a top journal. And I figure since most doctoral theses don't get published at all, let alone in top journals, that was in some sense an adequate qualification. And somewhere in that period, I met Jim Buchanan and discovered that he and I had very similar ideas about applying economics broadly to things like political institutions, which is what my Size of Nations piece was on, after all. And he was sort of the de facto dictator of the BPI Economics Department at the time, and he invited me to come to BPI, and I gave a talk there and got invited to come to BPI as an assistant professor of economics with no degrees in economics. In fact, no courses in economics.
And so where did you learn economics? At home? For yourself?
I think the answer is a combination. I think part of it was at home, just conversation. Part of it was thinking things through for myself. And part of it was that I suspect deliberately, though I'm not sure, in my first few years at BPI, I taught most of the curriculum, most of the syllabus, and I taught a bunch of different things, and teaching things is a great way of learning them. So I think it was really the combination of those things. But then in some ways, it was only when I wrote my price theory textbook that I learned it, in the sense that when I started writing the price theory textbook, if somebody said, how long would it take you to explain price theory to somebody, I would say, well, you know, a few hours for an intelligent person, basically a fairly simple set of ideas. And if they had asked me how many pages, I'm sure I would have said less than 100 pages. Maybe I can stretch it past 50. And I don't know what the book is, 300 or 400 or 500 pages long. But a lot of that was realizing when I actually wrote it, well, I know the top level of the analysis. But what does that depend on? What are my unstated assumptions? How do I know this is true? And thinking that through was an education.
And do you think the physics background changes the way you think about economics?
I don't think very much. I mean, it means that the math is easy, but...
Okay. Do they have a stricter framework because of that? More
scientific? I don't think so. Just different. Oh, yeah. This is other people too, I assume.
Did your father have influence on you once, or basically?
No, he certainly influenced the guy who was interested in economics, but I don't remember him taking any position on what I should do. The family joke when I was an undergraduate at Harvard was that I couldn't take an economics course. They'd fail me because I'd give them the right answers. but I don't know, you know, I just saw no particular reason to take them, doing other things.
Now, I'm curious, when did you become an anarchist and why?
What question? When I was in high school, as best I remember, my political position what was basically classical liberal, and that I couldn't see any moral justification for an obligation to obey law qua law. But I thought that people had to believe that in order for society to function. And I regarded that as an unsolved puzzle for me, and assumed that the right thing to do was to myself obey the law on the assumption that there might be good moral reasons, even if I hadn't found them, until I could solve that puzzle. And trying to remember the various things that happened. One thing that happened was there was someone called Bob Shookman, who was a few years older than I was, who was the founding president of Young Americans for Freedom, and who was a libertarian. I don't remember if he was an anarchist or not. And when I was looking at colleges, I visited him at Yale, and we had a discussion in which he persuaded me that there was no reason why government had to run the roads. And later, at some point in college, I noticed that while I was obeying the law, the people around me seemed to regard that as a somewhat bizarre attitude with regard to things like drinking ages and that sort of stuff. That in fact, it looked as though most people in my society believed that law was not morally binding, that, you know, laws you approved of were morally binding, and the other ones, like, you know, at what age you could drink and things of that sort, weren't. So it occurred to me that if that was right, my assumption that people had to believe that for society to function had to be wrong, because I was the only one around who believed it. And then I think the final step really was reading Heinlein's book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, because my view prior to that was that within a framework of laws, private arrangements would work, but that you needed an exogenous party, the government, to create that framework of laws. And Moon is a Harsh Mistress gave what seemed to me an internally consistent and persuasive story, not of my society, but of any society where that wasn't true, where you got, in effect, law through decentralized norm mechanisms rather than through a legislature and enforcement. And if there is one possible example, then there can't be a general theorem. One counterexample blows a theorem. So it couldn't be true, assuming he was right, assuming that I believed that he had given a consistent picture of his society, it couldn't be the case that in general you had to have a government to establish it. So I then started trying to think through what, in something like my society, a decentralized private law system would look like, and that's what Machinery of Freedom came out of, basically. And that was, I think I actually finished the book a little after I graduated, after I left graduate school, when I was a postdoc in physics at Columbia. So I would have been, let me guess, about 26 or so then. I graduated from college at 20. I was young. I went to college when I was 16. But so if I try to figure out sort of the timing, I think that sometime, I don't remember when Moon of the Harsh Mistress came out, because I probably read it when it came out, because I was a Heinlein fan, but I would have guessed that somewhere around 20, maybe a little earlier than that, would have been when I decided that you could have a functioning society without a government. I was, at some point, I think it may have started a little after I graduated from college, I had the Young Americans for Freedom had both libertarian and conservative members, although I think it was more conservative than libertarian at the time, and there were some internal conflicts. And they published a magazine called The New Guard, and I was their sort of token libertarian on the magazine. I had a regular column called The Radical. And in that, I know that I sketched out some of the ideas in sort of a fairly limited way for a private anarchist society. So that would, again, have been some point, probably when I was over 20, but not much over 20. No.
Really?
He thinks that that kind of society might work, but probably wouldn't, and I think it might not work, but probably would. That's not enough for a clash. The one point he did make, but it's not on the anarchist part, was it in Machinery of Freedom I approved too much? That if you look at the discussion of rent-seeking, though it wasn't called rent-seeking then in that book, it looks as though you should always essentially dissipate everything above subsistence on fighting each other for getting resources, and yet we observe that societies are much richer than that, and that therefore one really ought to think about why, even though government functions badly, it doesn't function as badly as one might on theoretical grounds expect.
I have a question. In your anarchist society, the society works on capitalistic free market system.
Right.
But there's also a libertarian tradition and anarchist tradition going to the socialist.
Yes.
I'm thinking specifically of Trump.
But the term libertarian has had lots of different meanings. And I think its original meaning was actually a believer in the doctrine of free will. But it has been used more in Europe than in the U.S. for roughly left anarchists.
And do you think there's things, well, I'm sure there are, but what do you think is the things that are in common between the socialist anarchists and the capitalist anarchists?
I would have said suspension of government would be the obvious thing in common. But from my standpoint, the fundamental problem with at least all of the versions of left anarchy I'm familiar with is they haven't thought about the coordination problem and how to solve it. Mm-hmm. And that therefore, you have this apparently insoluble problem. You've got huge numbers of people, each with his own specialized knowledge, abilities, desires, and so forth. How do you coordinate them? How do you, you know, we can't do very well if each of us is Robinson Crusoe. And as far as I know, the only lack of solutions that works for that beyond very small societies is something like market, some sort of decentralized, and you know, the details can vary a lot from society, but something where the basic mechanism is, I control this stuff, you control that stuff, I control these resources, maybe including my labor, you control yours, if I want your resources, I make you a deal. And that I don't see an alternative to that, and as far as I can tell, most of the left anarchists don't see that that problem exists, that they greatly underestimate how hard it is to coordinate, and they then sort of say, well, with goodwill, you know, even in a society where nobody owns means of production, if something needs to be done, people will figure out it needs to be done and do it, and that's probably an unfair oversimplification, but I don't think that they have really thought through that problem.
So basically, they don't think that the market is spontaneous order.
I wouldn't have put it that way so much. I would have said they don't see that the fact that we successfully coordinate depends on the spontaneous order of the market, and that it would be very this for a very small society. Of course, their system would work if you think about various, you know, monastery, religious communes, where you have a bunch of people. If you have a bunch of people with a lot in common, in effect, then you can do it by some mix of dictatorship and consensus, which is how such things, you know, how families run, basically. And I don't think they appreciate the fact that there are huge scaling problems as the size goes up. It is spicy.
It's spicy.
I have a question about Machinery of Freedom. I was wondering if there's anything, when you were thinking about all these future technologies and their functions, overall, does it change how necessary or not, or how harmful or positive government is?
I don't think there's a clear answer to that because there are so many possible futures. What is true is that one of the lines of technological development that I discussed there, and actually the one I really got interested in first, has the potential for giving you anarcho-capitalism online even while you have governments in real space. That if you think about the implications of public key encryption, you can have a future in which everybody controls the link between his online identity and his real space identity, in which real space transactions are enforced entirely by reputational means rather than in machinery of freedom. I'm assuming you can use force to, against people who cheat you or steal from you, whereas online you can't really steal from people in a sense. All you can do is defraud them. Because, you know, you can't. What? But that's the funny. We don't think of it that way. But what you're really doing is sending messages to their computer, which get their computer to do things they don't want it to do. You aren't literally physically grabbing the thing. I mean, one of the things I discussed in Future Imperfect is computer break-in as a metaphor. And I'm making the point that the same transaction, you can use several different metaphors with different implications to describe it, none of them very precisely, because it's a new thing in effect. And but as I say, but there's a real sense in which all you have is fraud, not force and fraud. And you can then, by reputational mechanisms, deal with that pretty well. And you could then end up with a world where a lot of what people were doing was really controlled by decentralized private mechanisms and private rules rather than by government. So that's the closest connection. But I also discussed at the end of the book the general question of whether technological progress can make us worse off. Because on the one hand, people have been warning it's going to happen for a couple of centuries. It never has happened. On the other hand, it's not clear that it's logically possible. The argument I make there goes back to the coordination problem. It is that there are really only two solutions to the coordination problem, and one of them doesn't work. And the one that doesn't work is centralized control. And the one that does work, and it's really a family of them, because you know, it's got a lot of detailed differences about what people do or don't own and such, are versions of the decentralized market approach. But in order for that approach to work, there's got to be some way of breaking up the world such that what I do mostly affects my part, plus maybe your part with your consent, and what you do mostly your part. And that if you're in a world where most of the things I do have most of their effects on 10 million people, and most of the things you do have most of it, then we're down from one solution to zero solution. Because you're not going to be able to use transactions, to use market transactions to get consent from 10 million people. You could try to use tort law, but tort law works very badly for that kind of problem. And that therefore, if technological change has its net effect, increases the range of our effects because it makes us more powerful, you could then have a case where the result of the technological change was to make it more and more difficult to use the only workable way of coordinating. And that's the case where I can see it making worse off. And a good example of that is global warming. I think global warming is greatly exaggerated in the popular discussion. You ask not how big is the problem, but how soluble is the problem, and the answer is it isn't. Because I take an action whose cost is dispersed among everybody on Earth. Not only can we not control it by private mechanisms, we can't control it by political mechanisms. There are lots of different countries. The Chinese are not going to stop their economic development to please us, nor is there any reason you think they should. And therefore, the same kind of public good problems reappear at the international level that you would have at the individual level. So it seems to me that if technological progress means that things like global warming become more common and bigger and more important, then you have a problem. At the same time, the progress, it can also go the other way. The technological progress can reduce transaction costs by greatly improving our paths, by greatly improving our information structure. They can make it easier to enforce property rights by making it easier to know what's happening, so that if you think about ways of monitoring pollution, it's not that I'm arguing that I predict that technological change will make things worse, but only that there is a logical way in terms of the economics in which it could. So that's, I think, relevant to all of these issues.
About AI, have you ever heard of Eliezer Yudkowsky? He works for the Singularity Institute in Palo Alto.
I think there's an Eliezer, I don't know his last name, who I think I have met and had exchanges with. That's probably the same person.
He blogged for Overcoming Bias.
Yeah, I think it's the same person.
Right.
I probably ought to read that, Bob, that blog. It's got some interesting people on it, but I haven't been.
Yeah. He thinks
but they read me, so that's all right. They had a discussion at one point I had that I raised in one of my blogs. It was sort of fun.
But anyway, he thinks that the most important thing in the world right now is to have that we make sure that AI starts out being friendly, and he thinks that otherwise it could just destroy the world.
That's clearly a possibility. Not destroy the world, just destroy us.
Destroy us, right. Yeah. So you think that's true?
I'm not sure I know what the solution is, though, but the one of the lines I used at the beginning of Future Imperfect when I used at the beginning of my Google book, no, Google talk, was that global warming is really a pretty wimpy catastrophe. That so the temperature of the world goes up by 2 degrees centigrade in 100 years, and sea level goes up by a foot or two, that's going to be a problem for some people in some places. I got three technologies that can wipe out the human race faster than that. And AI is one of the three.
Right.
Yeah, no, the way I make the argument is that Raymond Kurzweil's estimate is about 30 years to human-level AI.
Right.
Assume that Moore's law keeps working. In 40 years, we're German. And we better hope they're like pets.
Question right. What their motives are going to be. If they're programming themselves, can't they program motives?
I don't know. We aren't very good at doing that. We can make some attempts to program our own motives, but not perfectly. Yeah, first, we don't know how it can be done at all. I mean, it's not... The basic argument is that it looks as though the most plausible model for what we are is software running on the hardware of the brain. But that's only a guess. I mean, it's not like, you know, we can actually do it. You know, maybe there's really an immortal soul that's invisible or something. Who knows? But if that model is right, then that's a possibility proof for AI, because we're AI in effect.
Right.
And then the argument is, as our computers get better and as we know more about how intelligence works, eventually we'll be able to do it. But I just don't know. You know, maybe it turns out that for some reason the natural paths for AI give you artificial intelligence without its own purposes. All right? If it's possible to program an artificial intelligence as a person with its own will, but if it's also possible, maybe easier, to program an equally smart one that isn't, then we can have all of the slave AIs, as it were, on our side.
Robotic science is split on that issue, whether or not we're able to control them or their own mental
abilities.
What do you think
of
the possibility of us downloading our brains
to
computers?
Usually called
uploading. What do you think the world would be like, and like, how could we even have a government?
Yeah. I discussed that a little in Future Imperfect, not a lot.
Okay.
You start out, of course, with a philosophical question. Have you really uploaded yourself, or have you just got it somebody who thinks he's you? But suppose we can do it. Suppose we can observe your brain precisely, including its current state, and exactly model it on a computer. But suppose the process destroys your brain. How do you feel about it?
Well, yeah, that's the question. Are you still alive? I mean, because then you can become almost immortal.
Yeah, though we may be able to do that in the body too. And now when they make a second copy, which one is you? That is
the cloning issue.
That is, it isn't the cloning issue. It's real cloning. It's the real cloning, not what people. It's the issue that people who don't understand cloning think cloning is about. Cloning is not in fact making a copy of you. It's just making an identical twin. But this would be. That's right. And the, you know, I discussed some of this, and part of the point with regards both to upload and AI is that you have people who are very different from where you're used to people being, and your law and your customs and your language is going to have to somehow accommodate all that. That's not going to be easy.
Do you
consider the question of energy as being important? Because a lot of people right now with some debate on energy independence and different sources.
No, I mean it may have various effects in the short term, but this whole sustainability issue, which is one of the current catchwords, assumes stasis. It assumes a society where things aren't going to change very much. That's the least likely assumption. So that, you know, currently costs of solar energy have been going down, costs of fossil fuel have been going up, At some point they cross. At that point, that becomes one option. Other options, obviously, are nuclear, and there may be some others we don't know about. But in general, the as far as I can tell, you know, energy might be a bit more expensive, might be a bit less expensive, but I can't see any sort of fundamental reason why we will be out of energy in 100 years, so we may be using it in different forms. You know, I actually start the book by, we had a graduation ceremony of the law school some years ago, at which Mineta, the person the airport is named after, who was then Secretary of Transportation, I guess, was the speaker. And he was talking to some of the law students after his talk, and he said something to the effect that you know, someday, perhaps 100 years from now, someone is going to put his key into the ignition of the car and turn it, and the car won't start because there's no gasoline. And it struck me as an extraordinarily stupid statement, both because if he knew anything of the relevant economics, it wouldn't be a surprise what it would be with a long period of rising prices, which is what happens. But second, because he assumes that 100 years from now, people are going to get places by using internal combustion engines. It's at least as likely that the way you get someplace 100 years from now is you log on to the internet. Your virtual reality system means that for all practical purposes you're now there instead of here, even though your body seems to be happening here, sitting here. Or any of lots of other alternatives. But
we can all be on a hard drive in space.
But anyway. But it just does seem to me that there's a very strong conservative bias in most people's imagination of the future. That illustrates it. As I think I put it was like people worrying, as I guess people did worry 100 years ago, about how cities would manage when the streets were entirely choked with manure from all of the horses that were being used for transportation.
That's a really good point. This is the beginning of your book, I remember.
I think that was an idea someone else suggested. I think I had a running out of hay, and it was a better one, and I think I did actually find, I'm not sure, somebody worrying about that.
Okay, so I think that is going to be tied. You also describe yourself as an acronym, and what you tell us in your book. You have a deep interest in history, especially medieval times. How much do you think the past can be a guide to the future?
I think quite a lot. That not a guide in the sense of telling you what will happen, but of showing you some of the possibilities for human society. So that I teach a seminar about every other year at the law school called Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. And we start with modern gypsies, because modern gypsies in effect have their own legal system imposed on their own people, and mostly stay below the radar of official legal systems. And they have more than one, because of course the gypsies are scattered around the world as largely independent groups with different institutions. We go on to talk about Imperial China. I found a book which has 190 law cases from the last dynasty, mostly 18th and 19th century cases, trying to make sense of how that legal system worked. We talk about Saga Period Iceland, which is one I've long been interested in. We talk about classical Athens, about the Cheyenne Indians. There's quite a good book by a legal scholar and anthropologist written about 70 years ago, trying to understand how the Cheyenne Indians ran their affairs, when back before they were in the reservation. A bunch of others. 18th century England. And partly it's just fun, but partly also you get ideas, because you see here is how some people at some time solved this problem. So that, for example, one of the things that people worry about in the modern legal system is abusive litigation. That I sue you for a lot of money, I know that you're probably innocent, but if there's only a 5% chance of you're losing and it's a huge amount of money, you'll pay me off to drop the suit. The Athenians worried about that too. In the Athenian system, essentially all law was privately private. That their equivalent of the court-crime distinction was that the equivalent of court were offenses that could only be prosecuted by the victim, whereas other offenses could be prosecuted by any adult male Athenian citizen who wanted to. However, they had a big jury. Several hundred people on a jury. In fact, I think it was part of a welfare system that, that the jury pay was a way of feeding poor people who vote for you, so to speak. And one of the rules was that if the prosecutor failed to get, I think it was at least 30% of the jurors to vote for conviction, the prosecutor was fine. Well, I don't know if we should do that, but it's a neat idea. If you say, well, you know, is there an automatic mechanism for discouraging this by saying if you can't persuade at least a significant minority of the jury that you're right, you probably were wasting our time and so forth. Different example from Iceland, where they had a system where, again, it was entirely privately prosecuted system, and that the problem which arises in such a system, which is how do you deal with victims who don't have the equivalent of the money to hire a lawyer. And in the Icelandic case, it's more like we don't have friends who will fight for them if necessary. And the Icelandic solution is that a tort claim is marketable. So you can sell the claim to someone else who has the resources to prosecute it. And I've argued that that would make a lot of sense in our legal system for a variety of reasons. Third example is 18th century England. And 18th century England is a system where on paper it's a modern system with tort law and criminal law. So criminal cases are Rex v. so-and-so, the king versus so-and-so. But the king doesn't have any prosecutors. So all of those criminal cases that are the king against someone are actually being prosecuted by the victim. And this raises, not always the victim, anybody could, as in Athens, but in practice it's the victim. And then the question is, why do you bother? Because after all, a tort case, you prosecute it and the guy pays you damages if you win. Criminal case, you prosecute it and hang him. Doesn't get you anything. And there are, I think, two different answers. One of them is that you prosecute in order to be paid to drop the charges. That your objective is an out-of-court settlement, because he doesn't want to be hanged. Let me keep.
Do you want the other sauce too?
This is all right, sure. This is quite tasty. I don't think so.
Okay.
But the other reason is reputation, that you want to deter people from committing crimes against you. Now, if you're a likely repeat victim, you're running a cloth dyeing factory, and you've got lots of cloth out in the air drying, and you're at continual risk that thieves will steal some of it, then it would make sense the first time somebody steals from you, you prosecute them so the others won't. But the ordinary citizen isn't going to have that kind of reputation. And what they came up with was a society for the prosecution of felons. And there were several thousand of these in different towns at different times. And it was basically a group of people, each of whom chipped in an annual fee, which went to a pooled fund that would then pay the expenses of prosecuting a felony committed against any one of the members of the association. And the final stage in the process was that the list of members of the association was published in the newspaper for the felons to read.
Yeah, and then I remember there was...
So it was a way of pre-committing to deterrence.
If a person is not sick, they don't pay their dues for those months.
So that, and that, it seems to me, might be a useful mechanism, maybe it exists, I don't know, for things like protecting computers against people breaking into them. That if you said, the first thing you see when you break into this computer is a sign which says, by the way, I'm a member of Vengeance Incorporated. They have a bunch of high-class people who try to track down anybody who breaks into our computers and prosecute them to the full extent of the law. So basically, I mean, my first assumption is that people aren't very much smarter now than in the past. And that rather than saying, well, they did it that way because they didn't know any better, you ought to say, well, that was a working way of doing things. It might have been better than we do. It might be worse, different. And if you're considering the future when circumstances are going to change, then one of the things you want to think about is whether some of those things will be relevant. For instance, one of the things I discuss in the book is surveillance technology. And on the whole, I'm unhappy with surveillance technology. That you have video cameras up on poles, very common in England, somewhat common in the U.S. And the next step in the process is that those video cameras are feeding not to a screen a human being is watching, but to face recognition software. And that means that with a suitable database, you now have the potential for somebody who's got access to this information to punch a few keys and find out where you were Friday at 3 in the afternoon and see a film of it. Because the computer is keeping track of who is in each of those pictures. And if you have enough video cameras, that covers all public places. In many ways, that's a disturbing idea. On the other hand, one interesting potential is that then all criminal cases start looking a lot like tort cases. Because whereas we usually think of it as a criminal case where the police have to go investigate and find out who did it, we now have a world where the arguments are only about the legal implications of what you did. Everybody knows who did it. It's on tape. Everything's on tape. So that's sort of an interesting case where the technology leads to something more like the Icelandic or even the 18th century English system than the modern system.
When you think about these different visions of the future and notes, and when you contemplate the past, which one do you prefer? Which one do you find more enjoyable? Thinking about what they did or those things in the past or contemplating the future?
Both are interesting. But the past we can actually find out. The future, you've got to guess.
It's a different kind of exercise.
Yeah. Yep.
I did have a philosophical question for you. A lot of the, well, many of the political philosophers, like liberalism, libertarianism, socialism, capitalism, even the conservative movement, they all claim that they want to defend human liberty. And liberty seems to be one of the main issues in philosophy and politics. And it seems to be important to you, where one of your books is called The Machine of Freedom. What does this concept of freedom or human liberty mean to you? And why do you think that people come up with such different interpretations of it?
That is, the obvious sort of problem or ambiguity is what I think of as the distinction between liberty and power. That if, suppose technological progress makes it possible to do a bunch of things that couldn't be done before. In one sense, my freedom is much greater, but I think it is more useful to call that power and not freedom. Because back when I couldn't fly because nobody admitted an airplane, nobody was restricting my freedom. It wasn't that I was being oppressed, I just there were fewer things I could do. So to me at least, it's worth distinguishing freedom and power, but I can see why many people would say, well, why should you distinguish them? After all, what really matters is what you can do. Why should you care why? And I guess my answer would be because this is a discussion of political institutions, and the political institutions aren't the reason it is or isn't possible to fly, but they are the reason it is or isn't possible to smoke marijuana or whatever you want to do. So once you think of liberty as other people illegitimately restricting you, first of all, people are restricting you. And you then say, but wait a minute, what about I want to kill people? They restrict me from that. And I can see somebody could argue, well, that you would be more free in a society where there was nobody preventing you from killing people, as long as nobody else killed you. But at least to my intuition, it seems to me as though freedom is really about being restricted from things that you in some sense have a right to do, and that then gets into the very difficult problem of what rights people have. And you know, like everybody else, I've got opinions on that, but I don't think they're opinions where I can prove that they're right.
So is that the distinction then between freedom and power, which you have a more
freedom and power would be the first distinction.
But what would the distinction be? Would that be based on your right to do something?
No. That would be the second one. The freedom versus power is a distinction between what you can do being restricted by what other people do and all restrictions, including restrictions on what's possible, as it were. So that somebody in a highly advanced society, which is politically very unfree and oppressive, may well have more power than a primitive in a very free society. Because he loses from the fact that the government will let him do A, B, and C, but he can do D through Z that were impossible for the primitive. So that would be the... But I then, the sort of the next step is to say that I don't count in freedom the way the other people would, things where the reason you can't do them is other people's actions, but where to me that action is legitimate because what you want to do is something you have a right to do. And one way you could put it, though not the way I would put it, is to say what we want to do is to maximize freedom and my having a right to kill you reduces your freedom more than increases mine. But that's not the language I naturally think in. I would have said, no, I don't have a right to kill you in the first place, therefore not letting me kill you isn't a restriction of my freedom. And that, and what
you wouldn't call it.
That's right. But I'm only making the point that there's really a two-step thing from power to sort of freedom broadly defined to freedom narrowly defined as I would like to do it. And the problem with the first step is pretty easy, and the problem with the second step is that you need some theory or some idea of what rights people have, and that's something where I'm not sure there is a very clear answer to it.
Well, do you have the freedom to lie?
What?
Did you say you have the freedom to lie?
That's an interesting question.
I think I would say that it's going to depend on the context. That
if my lying consists of handing you something which I claim is X when it's really a Y and you're giving me money for it, then it seems to me I don't have the freedom to do that because I am then, in effect...
That's kind of like stealing.
That's right. But if my lying is somebody saying, are you really in love with that woman? And I don't want to say, maybe because I really am and don't want to get rivals warned, or maybe I'm really not and I'm trying to seduce her and don't want her to know that I'm not in love with her, you're going to go either direction. It's not clear to me that lying is a violation of anybody else's rights, although on the whole I disapprove of it. But
like, I think you're going to rights in terms of other people, but you can still be free to do something immoral.
Oh, sure.
I think that's where the difference comes in freedom as in the broad sense,
yeah.
And freedom is the narrow
sense. Even my narrow sense, there are things that are immoral in the sense that I think there are good reasons you shouldn't do them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know if lying is the best example, but I would say that refusing to help somebody under circumstances where the person is a deserving person, it wouldn't cost you very much to help them, it would be a lot of money, is a bad thing to do, but nonetheless, that it is part of your freedom to be able to do that. Now, I should say I also have a discussion, a published article on rights, in which I try to analyze it entirely from a positive rather than a normative standpoint. And that's one where I'm really regarding it as a behavioral phenomenon, not as a moral category.
What's the title of the article?
The title of the article is A Positive Account of Property Rights, but it isn't really property rights. That's just because the symposium I was writing it for or whatever. And it's on my webpage. And what it actually turns out to connect to quite closely is the puzzle of what is or isn't a government. And that...
we had a big discussion on that.
I had sort of the germ of the idea in Machinery of Freedom, and I thought it through much more clearly later. And it comes out of a bunch of other things sort of in my intellectual history. And imagine that you're living in sort of an ordinary society like ours, and your neighbor says to you one day, I've been thinking about dumping my trash on your property. And you know and I know that law enforcement around here is sufficiently slack that it would be an awful lot of effort for you to do anything about it. But I'll tell you what, if you'll pay me $10 a month, I won't dump my trash on your property. And now let us suppose for a moment that the cost to me of his dumping the trash on my property is more than $10 a month. The cost to me of trying to use legal mechanisms to stop him is much more than $10. I still don't agree to the deal. And the reason I don't agree to the deal, in my view, is a commitment strategy. That I have, and I think everybody else has, a set of ideas of my rights, whether I call it or not, which involve a set of, if you do this, I will resist it unreasonably hard. And the reason that being unreasonably hard resistance pays is that people know that I'm like that, therefore they don't do this, and therefore I don't have to resist it. So it really is, if you think about logical movement strategies. And it's connected with Schelling's idea of Schelling points, or focal points, which is that... Schelling has a very interesting old article which start, again, it seems unrelated to this, but it really isn't. He starts out with the following problem. You've got two people, students, somewhere doing an experiment somewhere outside of New York City. And the professor says to them, here's the deal. I'm going to talk to both of you separately. He does talk to them separately. You are to meet in New York City tomorrow. You have to be at the same place at the same time, and you cannot speak to each other in advance to coordinate on where you will be. If you succeed, you get $100. And the question is, where do they go? And there isn't an ambiguous answer. And when? That's first question. When do they try to meet?
Noon,
probably. Under the clock at Grand Central Station is a standard answer. I think it was their answer, if I remember correctly. My mistaken answer was the top of the Empire State Building. It turns out there is no such place, that there are four different observation decks.
Oh, yeah.
But the basic point Schelling was making is that what they're looking for are answers that they perceive as unique. Because if there are three of these and seven of these, but only one of these, then by both picking the thing there's only one of, we'll end up in the same place. And he then suggests that there are quite a lot of situations where the outcome of a sort of strategic interaction depends on perceptions of unique outcomes. So that standard example, two bank robbers splitting the loot. Each of them really believes he did more than half the work or took more than half the risk, but they agree on a 50-50 split. Because they both see that as a unique outcome, and the alternative is not 50-50 versus 55-45, it's 50-50 versus arguing about it, because there are a whole lot of other things that can happen. So that's a Schelling point, or a focal point. And in my view, part of what's going on in Wright is focal point. That to me, the landlord whose neighbor is trying to extort money from him, I say, well, look, in principle, saying, well, I'll pay you $1 but no more than that could be just as much a commitment as paying nothing, but it doesn't feel like it. Because it isn't unique in the sense of saying, you know, not a penny for tribute, whatever that famous quote is. Millions for defense, but not a penny for tribute. So, as I see it, Let me start from a different side. This is sort of a set of ideas that I come at from different angles. Hobbes describes the state of nature, all right, famous, where life of man is, etc. What is the difference between a state of nature and what we're living in? What do you add to the conditions of the state of nature that give you a state of civil order? Well, is it that there are police? It can't be that there are police. What keeps the police from using violence to grab stuff from you? That there are judges? What makes them? It isn't the uniforms. It isn't the law book. It's some patterned behavior by the people. And I would have said that there is a sense in which we are in a state of nature. It's just a very orderly state of nature. There's a state of nature where everybody has commitment strategies. Those commitment strategies defend the boundaries of their rights. Everybody at least roughly agrees on the strategies. Not that I don't have a right to violate your rights. I mean, if I could persuade you to pay me money for not dumping garbage, that's fine. I'm that much like you, let's suppose. But I realize that I won't get away with it. Because I recognize what your commitment strategy is, you recognize what mine is. They are consistent commitment strategies. We get in trouble if I'm committed to go this far and you're committed to go this far and we keep running into each other. So from that standpoint, in my view, that explains rights as a positive behavior pattern. That the sense in which we observe rights is we observe that there are certain lines which some other people cross. I won't pay an infinite cost to prevent it. When the mugger tries to take my money, he's obviously got a gun pointed at me, I give him my money. But if I could fight him off at a cost of only three times the amount of money he's trying to steal, I would do it. So that in that sense, rights, positive rights, are the implementation of this commitment strategy. And then that finally lets me define government. Because I originally defined government as an agent of legitimized coercion. And now that I have this view of rights, not as a moral category, but as a behavioral category, coercion is stuff that violates rights. And legitimized means not that people believe in it, they might or might not, but that people drop their commitment strategy against this actor. So what's special about government is that the same actions that would trigger these commitment strategies done by anybody else, like seizing my property without my consent, don't trigger them when government does them. And that, it seems to me, comes as close as I can come to defining the difference between a government and a non-government, between governments and private criminals and ordinary people, which are the relevant categories.
It's an interesting idea. It's almost like people fool themselves into believing that rights really exist, because that's not what goes through people's minds.
Right. But And I should say, this whole system wasn't invented by humans. We notice this in lots of other species. We call it territorial behavior in other species. It's not true of all species, but quite a common pattern, especially among birds and fishes, not so common in mammals, is that an individual or sometimes a mated pair in some way mark off a territory. When another member of their own species comes onto the territory, they fight it. And they fight more and more desperately the closer to the center of the territory. And the reason it works is that combat is not a zero-sum game. That as long as the defender isn't a lot weaker than the attacker, a fight to the death is a loss for both of them. Consequently, as long as the defender is believably committed to fight to the death against the trespasser, he doesn't pay to trespass. And this is a very common pattern observed in lots of animal species. Not that you get no trespassing, of course, but that you don't get might makes right. You don't get the stronger animal gets everything.
Yeah.
But rather, the stronger animal can generally persuasively defend a somewhat larger territory, but recognizes and usually respects the smaller territory of the weaker member of the same species. So, I claim far from people saying that right or property are a invention of human society, they're in fact a pre-human behavior pattern, and one which ultimately comes out of commitment strategies. In the animals, the commitment strategies are hardwired in and aren't very flexible. The humans, I think they're hardwired in as a potential, but we've got a lot more flexibility for how we influence. That's my view of it. But as I say, a positive account of property rights is on my webpage, and the article that explains this stuff. One of the other examples I give is the Falklands War. That if you think, in this case, it's countries, not individuals. The Falklands weren't worth anything like the cost England paid to defend them. At least I don't think they were, as far as we know. And yet, England was committed to a strategy of, if you seize British territory, we will fight unreasonably hard. Again, not instantly hard. You know, when the colonialists seized a bunch of British territory in the New World, eventually the British gave up. But we'll fight unreasonably hard to stop it because we want to be committed to this strategy, because that's the easiest they won't try to take ourselves. Similarly, going back to the question of why you prosecute people under a private prosecution system, people sometimes say, well, it's vengefulness. And my reply is, yes, but vengefulness is simply the internalized commitment strategy of, I will be the kind of person who hurts people who hurt me, therefore don't hurt me.
I do have a last question.
All right.
In your book, you describe the different possibilities of progress in medical science.
Yep.
We'll be able to live a longer life, possibly, and then what would we do with this life? Well, maybe people are going to change their careers or whatever.
Much longer life. Right.
If that happens, what would you do?
Well, I already have.
Oh, you already have.
Yes.
continue what you're doing now.
I published my first novel 2 years ago.
Oh, so you're already changing.
I have written the second novel. I am working on sequels to both of them. They're unrelated novels. And my father's comment after he read my first novel, which he liked, was, I'm sorry to lose you to economics.
I'm sorry to lose you to economics. Oh.
And he's right in the sense that I'm still doing economics. I'm still interested in it. But if I say, when I'm lying in bed trying to fall asleep, what I'm thinking about is not some interesting bit of economics, typically. It is, how do I handle the plot of the novel?
Oh, you're
not an art director, but... So in that sense, I think I are, even with the normal human lifespan. But in a sense, I've been doing it for a long time on a smaller scale. That, you know, I was doing, first I was doing physics, then I was doing economics sort of generally, with an interest in public choice. Then I was doing law and economics, which was my field for a couple of decades, basically. I'm at Santa Clara because they wanted somebody in law and economics, and I'm still teaching that course, but I teach that course one semester every other year. So a majority of what I'm teaching is other stuff, and so I keep on reinventing, finding other interesting things to do, to a considerable extent, things that I think will teach me something. So that Future Imperfect came out of the seminar I taught for many years there. The seminar on legal systems is very different. I hope will eventually generate a book, though I haven't gotten far enough to do that yet, and so forth. help.
So it would be basically writing fiction.
For a while.
For a while. Until something else.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And I'm also spending a notable amount of time doing blog posts, and that's really, in a sense, it doesn't pay very well, but it's a career in the sense that it's an activity which affects the world, which is sort of a kind of, journalism isn't right, it's more like essays. It's closer to Montaigne's essays, or at least what my blogs are, and that it's, brief bits on something, and the something could be politics, it could be philosophy, it could be philosophy of science, which I had a long discussion, a long piece on, that got a lot of responses, and it could be almost anything. Could be technology. I've had a number of sort of geek posts about, the latest gadget I'm looking at and things of that sort.
Can I ask you about, a religious question?
Sure.
What do you think, usually most people think that religion has negative, or throughout history it has had negative externalities, right?
I wouldn't have said that. I have no idea if that's true or not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Could have positive and negative effects.
Okay.
To the extent that your religion makes you not lie, cheat, and steal, that's
okay.
A benefit for the rest
okay.
of us. To the extent that it makes you go around killing people if they won't convert, that's a loss for the rest of us.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the argument between Adam Smith and David Hume on the subject of an established church?
No.
England, of course, had an established church. Still does, in fact. And Hume was in favor of it. And what makes this interesting is that Hume was widely believed to be an atheist.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and in fact, Smith got in a good deal of trouble for giving an account of Hume's deathbed, which made it clear that he was not, dying in terror of oblivion. And Hume's argument was that the established church bribed the indolence of the clergy. That if you didn't have an established church and you were a clergyman, how do you make a living? You whip up religious passions, you tell your people how what you're teaching is true and right and everybody else is wrong, and that causes a lot of trouble. But now suppose you have an established church. How do you make a living as a clergyman? Well, you're not getting paid by the people you're preaching to. You're getting paid by the state, with who gets what pay determined by various aristocrats who've got control over this or that religious position. So what do? You give a sermon with lots of Latin quotes and references to classical authors. You, of course, have to take the political views consistent with those of your patron, but you're basically appealing to upper-class attitudes. You're functioning as sort of a rather poor member of the upper class rather than as an entrepreneur in the religion market. That results in nobody takes religion very seriously, which is a question what eventually happens in England, and therefore in a much more peaceful world. And Smith argued on the other side, and Smith's argument was that in a society with lots of different religious sects, each religious sect has an incentive to monitor the behavior of its members in order to maintain its reputation.
Competition kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. So it's a really neat argument. These two people are, with Hume taking what seems like the opposite of the side. Smith really does believe in God. Hume very likely doesn't. So that sort of is an interesting discussion.
Right.
What about the rights violations? If you're advocating an established church, then the other people will have other religions.
Yeah, sure. That's right.
So
well, Hume was discussing the consequences. Hume wasn't arguing about individual rights.
Okay.
And of course, the established church didn't forbid other religions. It just meant that one religion was subsidized.
Okay, and by that definition, that's oftentimes
is,
they also did forbid.
In the case, in 18th century England, there were limitations in other religions that you couldn't be a member of Parliament, I think when Hume was writing, if you were a Catholic, and you probably couldn't be an officer in the army if you were a Catholic. That was what they were mainly worried about because of the previous Catholic-Protestant conflict. But it was perfectly legal to be a Catholic or to be a dissenter. Yeah, well, that's what Hume was writing. Or to be either a dissenter or a Catholic, or a Jew for that matter.
Would you still have the entrepreneurial problem that some people would...
But the established religion reduces it because most of the population is in the established church and they aren't facing that. Yeah, no, of course, but anyway, I just thought it was sort of a neat discussion.
That is interesting, yeah.
And it's an example of sort of the more general thing that what we call economic imperialism wasn't invented by Gary Becker, that you get essentially economic imperialism in Smith, attempts to use the economic way of understanding stuff to make sense of what other people don't think of as economics. That is, a famous example would be the decline of feudalism. I don't know if you're familiar with Smith's discussion of this, but the diamond shoe buckle discussion, where he's arguing basically that in a society with not very much trade, you're a feudal lord. Your income is coming basically in beef and beer and wheat and stuff like that. How can you spend it? And the answer is that you can't spend much of it on luxuries, because there aren't many luxuries to be had. But you can spend it on supporting retainers, on people who will do what you tell them, tell you how important you are, make you feel like a high-status person, and so forth. And since you've got all these retainers hanging around, you've got a private army, and you get feudalism. All right. Now, he says, as trade revives, you have the option of selling some of your beer and grain and beef and using the money to buy diamond shoe buckles. Anybody would rather spend money on himself than on somebody else. So once there's actually a useful way of spending the money on yourself, you scale down the number of retainers around your household and use the money to buy luxury goods for yourself. Now, he says, it's true, you are still supporting just as many people as before, but now a bunch of them are all scattered around the world making diamond shoe buckles. They're not going to take your orders or fight for you. So now the feudal lords no longer have private armies and feudalism is all. I'm not sure if he's right, but it's a really neat application of economics. I've never done it, but I wanted somebody to try to see if you could test it. And the test that I want, but I don't know if it's doable, is consider two feudal lords, one of whom is producing grain, and one of whom is producing wine. Grain you could feed your retainers with. You can't feed very many. Your retainers are happy to have wine, but they aren't going to be able to live on it. So if your main source of revenue is wine, you have to export the wine and import the grain. That means that the rate of exchange for you between retainers and diamond shoe buckles is much more favorable to diamond shoe buckles than it is for the guy who is growing subsistence crops and therefore can have them consumed by retainers without the cost of exporting and importing. Hence, if Smith is right, we ought to have seen feudalism declining earlier in places where a large part of what they were producing was export goods, and later where they were producing subsistence goods. Now, whether there are large enough differences in historical Europe for you to be able to really test that, I don't know, but it struck me as a case where you could, in principle, do an empirical test of this theory.
You could somehow control the other variables.
Yeah. That, in general, sort of one of the things I learned from trying to write for a journal of political economy was this rule of thumb that whatever your theory is, you ought to figure out how it could be tested. And the interesting lesson there, this was my piece on size and shape of nations, where when I first submitted it, I got it back from George Stickler, who was the editor of something I'd known since I was a small child, saying that it wasn't publishable unless I had some empirical tests of my theory. And he had some suggestions, none of which I think were workable for how to test it. But I came up with some very different tests, which I actually did, and which on the whole supported the theory, not very strongly, because you know, we don't have very good data on the last 1,000 years, which is what I was covering, more than that 1,500 years. But the interesting lesson for me was that in the process of finding empirical tests, I had to think of the theory much more precisely. I had to, as it were, in effect, do the equivalent of substituting math for words. Because exactly what am I saying? You have to know that in order to know the implications. And so it was a much, much better article as a result of my following George's orders and published it. So, and many, many years later, there is a small literature on the size of nations of people still occasionally write on it. And somebody had a sort of survey of that literature. The first article in that literature is mine. And the second article in that literature is written by Jim Buchanan 10 years later. At least on that person's survey. Oh, that was better than But, and I started out with a puzzle. And the puzzle was, when the Roman Empire fell, why did it break? That is to say, Roman Empire falls. Why wasn't it succeeded by other states of a similar size? Why did you go from this sort of the whole Mediterranean world plus France, England, one country, as it were, one and a half countries. There was some division east-west by then. Why do you go from that to a world where the real unit of government is the barony, little tiny things? And I had it. possible explanation of that is dependent. A theory of the size and shape of nations, and it's also on my webpage.
Okay. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, one of the really nice things about the web is that you don't have to go search out old copies of the JPE to find it. And in particular, my population piece was a pamphlet, not a journal article. So that would be almost impossible to find as a physical copy. If you were lucky, I've occasionally noticed it when my daughter was looking at colleges, one of the things I would do would be to check online for their library to see which of my publications they had. And I think one or two of them had that. But it's not something you'd expect to find, but you can find it on the web very easily because it's on my webpage.
Okay. Maybe another question I had.
Sure.
What would you tell students of economics? Why should they study economics? Why is it important? How would you encourage them?
Oh, I do it because it's fun.
Uh-huh.
And so the encouragement I would give would be think of some interesting problems that you can make sense of with the economic approach. But that's a very small fraction of the profession. And presumably most people study economics so they can get a good job doing it. Reasons of that sort. And sort of my view is that you ought to have fun doing what you're doing. Not that you should never, I mean, obviously, you know, there are circumstances where you need the money, but that on the whole, it's a good strategy to try to find things that you enjoy as well as there's a line in a Frost poem, my object in life is to unite my vocation and my avocation as the two eyes make one in sight. Oh, that's a pretty good line.
Do you have any advice for people going into law, maybe?
Oh, boy. No, I'm not in law, really. I'm a law professor, but not a lawyer, so I don't know what the right advice is. You know, at the moment, high-tech law is a very hot issue, but everybody knows it's a hot issue, there'll be a lot of people going into it, so I don't know if it's really the right thing to go into or not.
And one thing, what do you think about the present crisis in finance?
I think it's exaggerated. I could be wrong. It's not my field, so I'm not in a position to sort of judge all the details. I've had a couple of blog posts on it in describing at least my very imperfect perception of what's going on, which is first that the initial problem is really coming out of the attempt to get housing loans to people who couldn't get them on the private market, which is what Fannie Mae was set up to do 70 years ago. And I discuss in some detail why I think that led to problems, depending really on an implicit government guarantee, even though there wasn't an explicit one. And the other point I make in a different blog post is that the term money is used in two entirely different ways to get confused, and that's partly related to why people think this is going to be a Great Depression, when I don't think there's any reason to think it is. That money is used both for the money supply and for wealth. So when you say he has lots of money, you're not saying anything at all about the size of his checking account or how much green paper he has. You mean maybe you mean he's got land worth millions of dollars or other. But the Great Depression comes from a collapse in the money supply. I can see no evidence that anything is going to happen is going to make the money supply collapse. That runs on banks don't make the money supply collapse because they've got FDIC insurance, so that your deposits, your checking account can't go private unless the government goes broke, which is unlikely. So what's happening is lots of people are discovering they're poorer than they thought they were. Well, that's a very large loss of money in one sense, but no loss of money in the other sense. So in that sense, I might be wrong, but it looks to me as though the thing is exaggerated, partly because people who would like their share of $700 billion would like to make look, and partly because the news media, of course, want a good story, and the end of the world is a much more interesting story than bad year this year.
Definitely.
But we will see. And I could be wrong. As I say, it's not my field. So.
Wonderful.
But you can find those comments on my blog.
I'll check it out. Thank you so much.
Thank
it was
you.
A real pleasure.
Thank you for lunch. It was a very good lunch.